The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Well, we're here, kind of. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. So, we're having some technical difficulties on the video streaming side. So those of you who are over at YouTube waiting for the show to start, all of a sudden, literally 10 minutes ago, everything stopped. Everything just shut down. It was all working fine, and then it just went dark. I think it's because my computer thinks I'm cheating on it, because I'm looking for a new laptop, because, you know, we're moving to Arizona, and it's going to be a while until I can get my studio built again once we get moved. And so I've been researching all day a laptop that would be powerful enough to run my equipment so I could, you know, do a remote broadcast. And what happened is, all of a sudden, now my YouTube interface is not working. So let me, you know me, I'm the queen of the multitasking. Here I go again. Let me try to get this working. I honestly do not know what happened. The YouTube sign-in page has been opened in your default web browser. Use this to sign into your account. My default web browser. There is no page open in my default web browser. Man, oh man, oh man. Well, let's try it like this anyway and see what happens. I'm sorry. So while I do this, I you know, the queen of the multitasker, I am signed in. Manage my account. Okay. I'm signed in here and I'm signed in there. Man, oh man, oh man. This is so... All right, what if I sign out and then try to sign in again? I'll try that. So in the meantime, while I'm doing this, let me tell you a little bit about what happened over here this weekend. So I know it was a while ago, but oh man, this is not fun at all. So I know it was taped, I think, back in October, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. But I got to tell you, we watched it over the weekend, watched most of it anyway. And a lot of the artists I just sort of fast forwarded through because they didn't really interest me. But all right, so this is that. Okay, that's there. Anyway, but one of the inductees really stopped me cold in my tracks. And I'll tell you, I'm not a big John Mellencamp fan. I never was. I always thought he was sort of like a Springsteen wannabe and never quite as good. But he went up a bunch of notches in my view after watching this show last night, because it was up to him to induct his lawyer. Yeah, apparently this guy is like mega music industry lawyer, and his name was Alan. Wait, let me pull it up for you because I don't want to screw it up. Alan. What's your last name? Alan. Damn it, Alan Grubman. Alan Grubman. So while I'm trying to figure out the stuff here, let me share with you a little bit of what John Mellencamp said. So he's talking about his lawyer, and he's inducting this lawyer into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I want to share with you one of the first things Alan said to me when we were both kids. He said, look here, John, here's the way the music business works. There's a great big motherfucking tree standing on top of a hill. This tree is massive, and it'll figure out a way to survive anything that they care to throw at it. And on this tree are a bunch of apples.
Okay.
There are a few apples that stay firmly attached to the tree. And they seem to grow bigger and better every time you look at the tree. But most of the apples, sorry to say, they shrivel up and drop to the ground, sadly forgotten. It's my goal to make sure that anyone I represent never falls off that tree.
Okay, that's nice, but what comes next is even better.
This apple has managed to stay on that tree in no small part to my lawyer, my friend, and my rabbi, Alan Grumman. Also, Alan is Jewish. I'm an artist and a Gentile whose life had been enriched greatly by my friendship and association with countless Jewish people. Guys, I cannot tell you how fucking important it is to speak out if you're an artist against anti-Semitism, against all forms of hatred. Here's the trick. Silence is complicity. I want to say I'm standing here tonight loudly and proudly and in solidarity with Alan, his family, and all my Jewish friends, and all the entire Jewish people of the world. Fuck anti-Semitism.
That was John Mellencamp, and how awesome of him for saying that. Look, this obviously, this part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony had nothing to do with this other than the fact that the lawyer who Mellencamp was inducting, his lawyer, was a Jewish man. And I guess, you know, the instances of anti-Semitism happening in this country these days is so pervasive that he felt he had to do that. So someone in the chat room is telling me my YouTube page is saying I won't be on for another hour. Well, my YouTube isn't working now. So I am on now, audio only today. Sorry. Believe me, not in my control. And I'm telling you, this is, I believe... it's the gremlins that live in my studio paying me back because I've been looking for another computer. Wow. And I don't know what the problem is here, but I am this is not working. So anyway, that happened. And I do have a guest coming up, and I actually asked him to come back in a little while because I needed to deal with these technical problems. But you know what happens? Once there is a technical problem and I cannot reboot the main computer, otherwise we lose the audio stream as well, there's not a whole lot I can do. Not a whole lot I can do. I can play for you this ad. Let me do this because, again, I'm all discombobulated now. Nothing is working the way it's supposed to. But early voting began Saturday in Georgia, in the race between, inexplicably, Herschel Walker and the Reverend Senator Raphael Warnock. And apparently, Warnock has a new ad running. I haven't heard it yet, but I have the tape queued up to where the ad begins. I guess they played it on Morning Joke this morning. And I got to the beginning where they set it up, but I haven't had a chance to actually... listen to it, but I will now with you. So here's how that ad goes. And apparently all they do is they show Georgians snippets of Herschel Walker's campaign stump speeches, I think. Here's how the ad goes.
You ever watch a stupid movie late at night hoping it's going to get better, don't get better, but you keep watching it anyway? Because the other night, I was watching this movie. I was watching this movie called Fright Night, Freak Night, or some type of night. But it was about vampires. I don't know if you know vampires are cool people.
What the hell is he talking about?
Yeah. Is he serious? Is he for real?
But I'm going to tell you something that I found out. A werewolf can kill a vampire. Did you know
that? What is he talking about?
I never knew that, so I didn't want to be a vampire anymore. I wanted to be a werewolf.
Oh, my gosh.
He's talking about vampires and werewolves right now.
Yeah, y'all serious about this, right?
So I've been telling this little story about this bull out in the field.
What on earth?
And three of them are pregnant.
There's no substance. There's nothing.
So you know you got something going on.
It makes me want to laugh, and then it makes me think we're in trouble.
But all he cared about is kept his nose against the fence, looking at three other cows that had been blown to him. Now all he had to do is eat grass.
This video is ridiculous. I asked 35 seconds of my life I'll never get back.
Why would I want someone like that leading the state of Georgia?
I was good air, decided to float over to China, bad air.
Unbelievable.
So when China gets out of good air, their bad air gotta move.
It's all the same air.
Not only does it make no sense, I don't even understand what he thinks he's saying.
So it moves over to our good air spaces. And now we gotta clean that back up.
I sit and watch these on Twitter and I'm like, what the heck is this guy talking about? Like, literally, what is he talking about?
He's completely unqualified for this really, really serious job.
No one's watching this and being like, oh man, that guy's got it together.
And sometimes, like, I read through the comments because I'm like, is anybody actually understanding, or are we just sitting here wasting time?
It is embarrassing. Let's call it what it is. It is embarrassing.
They just care about getting a yes man, somebody that had just punched the button.
I think it's a risk to me and millions of Georgians to put this man in a position of power.
Let's call it what it is. This is embarrassing as hell.
At all. I mean, well,
you
know.
She just put the headphones down and is walking away. Does Herschel Walker really represent you? So that's the new ad running in Georgia, I guess, put up by the Warnock campaign. And that's, you know, that's all you need to do. Let people listen to the man speak and get their honest reactions. I'm surprised that this is even a race, that there's even a contest here. But, you know, we are now a tribal warfare going on, and it's one side against the other, and it shouldn't be that way, but that's where we are. I want to go back a little bit. So I've alerted our guest that we are not doing video today due to technical difficulties, but it's radio. This show has always been a radio show. So with that, we are audio only on the Progressive Voices Network and at NicoleSandlerStream.com and, of course, on my website and other online audio radio stations that carry the show. So thank you for being here. I'm thrilled to welcome to the program Simon Rosenberg. Now, he's a veteran Democratic strategist. He's the founder of NDN, the New Democrat Network, and the New Policy Institute. He's a veteran of a couple of presidential campaigns. He was a senior role in the Clinton War Room. He's done a lot of work over the years on politics, on strategies and things like that. And he gained a lot of attention during the midterms because he pushed back against the narrative, the red wave narrative, the polling information predicting massive Democratic losses. So, I was following along and I thought, wow, it would be great to invite Simon onto the show for a bit of a postmortem about what happened and to say thank you for speaking out against the bullshit. So even though it's radio, it's internet radio, so I can curse. Hi, Simon Rosenberg. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity. And I'm with you on the force of language here, given what's happened in the last few months.
Yeah, well, it's necessary. So I want to talk about, actually, you and I met decades ago, and I've always remembered you because I used to work with Jim DeFede, who's the Florida political journalist. So these days he's at CBS4 in Miami, but he is the guy who knows Florida politics. And he hosted a morning show on when South Florida had a progressive talk station, when it was not only right-wing craziness assaulting your earwaves every day, but he did the morning show on 940 Winds. I was his producer after a year, he left and then I took over the show. But while Jim was there, you came on one day and I was so impressed by you that I always remembered you. I don't know why I never reached out before, but I guess it took your commentary on the midterms to get me to say, wait a minute, we got to talk. So thank you for being here and thank you for doing this work all through the years. So, you know, at the end of the election season, I don't like to call it election day anymore because we vote more than on just that one day. When everyone was screaming, oh, it's going to be a red wave, everyone but you, that is. And I said, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to fall into despair. I refuse to see defeat. I want to see the votes counted. Let's talk after the votes count, because I don't believe this polling. It's not like the polling's been accurate for the last couple of cycles. It just doesn't seem right. And you were saying that all along. Why did you go against all the pundits and the pollsters and the so-called journalists who were not reporting there, but commentating?
So a year ago, Joe Biden's approval rating started to drop. And, you know, he had been doing very well in his first year. And with COVID and the Afghanistan war, his approval rating started to drop. And what I noticed was that even though his approval rating was dropping, the what's called the congressional generic, which is the are you going to vote Democrat or Republican, didn't move. In fact, it stayed very positive for Democrats. That's not really supposed to happen. These two things are supposed to move together. And I tried to make sense of it in October of last year, of 2021. And what I concluded was that there was this MAGA hangover in America, that this thing that had driven the last two elections, the fear of MAGA, was likely to drive this one too, because the Republicans made a really big mistake in the election, which is rather than abandoning a politics that had failed for them in two consecutive elections, they ran towards it with incredible speed and intensity, and they embraced MAGA again. And what I sort of surmised then was that what we may be looking at is a very competitive election, because Republicans made a big strategic error by embracing this politics that had just been rejected overwhelmingly by the country twice. And it would be very easy for a voter to be disappointed in Biden and still want to have nothing to do with them, right? And have no intention of voting for them. So what I wrote then, and I was open to this idea that the election may actually be a very close competitive election. I had a theory that was a non-red wave theory. And by the spring, you know, after the Dobbs decision got leaked and Uvalde happened, we started seeing polling across the country, including polling that I was involved in, showing the Democrats doing better than expected and Republicans doing a little bit worse. And so I started writing in May that, hey, this looks like a close competitive election, not a red wave. And I wrote my first not a red wave article in June of 2022.
Wow.
And then we know what happened next, right? Dobbs happened. And then we know the election then fundamentally changed. And so throughout the summer and fall, we kept seeing more data showing that the election was a close competitive election, or even could be a good election for Democrats. We saw it in the five House special elections that took place, where we did much better than expected. We saw it in Kansas, which I'm sure you spoke about a lot. We saw it in the voter registration numbers, which saw a big spike across the country in women, but particularly young women registering in much higher numbers. We saw it in the candidate fundraising, where our candidates were raising much more money than their candidates. And so my partner, Tom Bonnier, who I did a lot of this analysis with from a company called Target Smart, what we said in the fall, as we were heading into the fall, was, look, on all these boxes we check for intensity, that we measure to see intensity of a party, we're checking all those boxes, and the Republicans aren't. And people better be open to this election being better for Democrats than we expected. We also had enough polling, and I can go into it more if you want, but there was also good, high-quality polls showing that the election looked better for Democrats than if you added all these junky Republican polls that were in the polling averages. And so in the last few weeks, we said, look, I think this looks pretty good for Democrats. And then the early vote came. And the early vote showed exactly the same thing, right? Showed heightened Democratic intensity, Republican underperformance. And so on election eve, I wrote a piece that said, look, if tomorrow's a better day for Democrats than people expected, let me explain to you why I think it's going to be the case. And I laid out exactly what we just discussed. And so I wasn't surprised by what happened on election night, but certainly I was really pleased. It was what happened.
As was I, definitely. But, you know, I'm reading through a lot of your notes and your blog that's up at ndn.org and a few other things that you wrote through that time. And you, I think you and I came to the same conclusion on one front. You blame the disconnect on massive media failure. You wrote, quote, there were a lot of really smart people who basically misled tens of millions of people through their political commentary in the final few weeks. And look, I've been railing against, as I'm sure you have, the horse race aspect of it, which is all the media, especially cable news, wants because it's good for their ratings. And that's what they wanted to gin up, you know, the competition, the horse race. But, you know, I'd hear people that should know better quoting polls that were not necessarily very fair. In fact, you cite partisan polling, that a lot of those were used. And can you explain how that works a bit?
Yeah, it's really important for people to understand this because something happened in this election. This is my 17th election cycle, right? Working as a Democrat, it's hard to believe. And so I've seen it all, right? And I've been part of presidential campaigns. I was an advisor of the DCCC. In 2018, so I was in the game recently, not just a long time ago. And so what happened this cycle was that the polling was actually good this time. The independent media polls were actually, when you strip out all the partisan polls, the independent media polls were actually pretty accurate. And that's why one of the reasons I think we got this call correct was that we were pulling those polls out from the junky political polls. What happened in the final month of the election is some group of Republicans flooded the zone with all of these very Republican polls. And we're talking about more than 40 polls in seven different states with 10 different pollsters. Nothing like this had ever happened before. I mean, they were having these obscure polling firms from Oklahoma City, all white polling firms polling in Georgia as if they have any expertise polling there, dumping these polls. And I became convinced that they were doing this to game the polling averages, to sort of produce the story that there was a red wave. It was a fiction. Because remember, the red wave fiction was actually the opposite of what happened in the election. It wasn't just a miss. It was the opposite, right?
Right.
And because what we actually had was Democratic intensity. We had all these measures of ongoing Democratic intensity. And so what a group of Republicans did, and we'll hopefully find out someday who funded this campaign, they did this to create a different story. The story was that there had been a popular uprising in America due to the extremist decisions of the Supreme Court, to the extremist trigger laws that were put into effect, that there had been an uprising. And that was the story. But then that story was replaced by the red wave story, which was that, in fact, women aren't enthusiastic, even though we've been seeing that they were for 5 months, and that women were more concerned about eggs costing 30 cents more than their bodily autonomy, which was in some of the most insulting and ridiculous commentary of the entire election. And that somehow a large number of largely white male commentators fell into this sort of facile place where, well, no, women really do care about eggs costing 30 cents more than the loss of bodily autonomy. And there's a red wave. And the red wave became a way of negating the passion and intensity we've been seeing from women for the previous 5 months. Mm-hmm. It was a negation. And I'm convinced that the forces that funded this, and I'm speculating now, a lot of what I talked about was data, were people who were invested in the Supreme Court decision, that were invested in the extremism of the court that people had spent a long time investing in creating, and that needed the story not to be that the extremism of the Supreme Court and cost the Republicans the election, but that there was this other thing that had happened. And the reason why is they wanted the court to continue to be extreme. They didn't want there to be pressure on the court and Republicans to try to pull back from the extremism that we had just seen in this first Supreme Court after Biden had been elected. And so I think there was a major effort to try to change the storyline of the election away from abortion was potentially going to destroy the Republican Party, as we saw in Michigan and other places, to one where women actually didn't really care about it all that much. And they failed. And it was a failed effort. And I'm really proud of the team that I worked with, who called, to your term, bullshit on this red wave narrative, which was more than anything else insulting to women across the country, in addition to insulting our intelligence. What's sad and what's tragic is that so many people in the media who are paid a lot of money to interpret this stuff for people fell for it when there was a compelling amount of information this wasn't happening. And that's really, to me, the greatest fail, was that there were lots of very prominent people that we all see on TV, that we list, that we read about, who are well-known political commentators, who fell into the red wave narrative. So to me, what happened, you know, many times in an election, you know, there'll be 20 people over here and 20 people over here. Everybody was over there. Mm-hmm. Everybody bought the red wave. Everybody had written the Democratic Party off. And so it was, to me, the biggest political journalism failure that I've seen in my 30 plus years of doing this. And remember, I grew up at ABC News. I started in this business as a TV producer and writer. I ran my radio station in college at Tufts University. I grew up in the media business as a TV producer and writer. I worked for Linda Ellerbee, who you may, you're, were.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Right. I was her writing assistant in a primetime television show. And so I grew up in that business. And so I know that business well. I know our business, right? Mm-hmm. The business you're in well. And I just couldn't believe. And so 2 weeks before the election, a fellow Floridian, Joy Reid, right, invited me to come on to MSNBC because she had seen the stuff I was writing. And I went on the air and I said, I'm really disappointed. There's clearly these bad Republican polls. There's clearly a campaign to game the polling averages. You can't trust 538 and Real Clear Politics anymore. And I said, people who are using this stuff are contributing to misleading the American people. I said this 2 weeks before the election. And the response to that was interesting, right? Nate Silver attacked me on his podcast the Thursday before the election by name. Other commentators, you know.
How did Joy Reid react? How did she respond to what you said?
Joy Reid gave me two entire segments on her show. Joy Reid's a hero of this story. Joy Reid's a woman. Joy Reid didn't buy into all this crap. Joy Reid, you know, gave me airtime to air this stuff out on national television. And I can tell you that it rankled a lot of feathers with a lot of people. And I continued with it because it's what the data was telling me. Every election's unique. No election is like any other election. You got to follow the data that's in front of you. And so I was proud that we called this out. But what was stunning to me is that so many people, including many people that people here probably respect and know very well, even after they were confronted with the data showing that there was this gaming of the polling averages, they stuck with it. Nate stuck with it. Other people stuck with it, right? People at the Cook Report, who are my friends, stuck with it. And so I think there's a lot of discussions that need to happen about how basically a political party that has spent the last two, there wasn't more skepticism that the a political party that has spent the last 2 years lying about the last election wasn't also lying about this one, which is what they were doing. They were lying about the red wave. And there should have been far more skepticism instead of believing that somehow, oh, that Republican Party that had just lied about the last election was somehow now this different party, when of course it was the same party. And lying is, you know, is what the modern MAGA Republican Party does. And I just don't know why so many people fell for it.
That's what gets me. I don't understand it. And, you know, I wasn't as in the weeds with the numbers as you were, but I didn't feel it. It's like, it's not like, yeah, I get the disappointment with Joe Biden. Whatever. I didn't think he was the right candidate in the beginning. Anyway, we went into it in a bad position, you know, but maybe Biden was the only one who could have beaten Trump. I'm not so convinced of that. That's a topic for another time, I suppose. Yep. But, you know, I was also disappointed in the Democratic Party and, you know, the women's movement. We all got out and marched the day after Trump was inaugurated. Where was the march after Roe was overturned? Where was the taking that momentum? Because the minute I heard that, after I got over my shock and stopped crying, I thought, well, the silver lining here will be that we're going to vote them out. And look, Michael Moore never went back. He believed it all along. But a lot of people started, you know, like, oh, Michael Moore's at it again, you know, making fun of him like he's going to be wrong. And there you are, the two outliers. And again, the last day, on that Tuesday, I had a guest on who was saying, well, we've got to brace ourselves. And I'm like, no, I refuse to go there. Let the people vote and then we'll talk. I'm not going to be sucked into this. And I'm glad I wasn't. Then again, Simon, I live in Florida and everything right. was back asswards here because you talked about the registrations being up. Well, what we saw in Florida was a state that had always historically had many more Democrats registered than Republicans. Right. In this last 2 years, that flipped. And Ron DeSantis is now all of a sudden being painted as a normal Republican, like a return to sanity. No, that's more of this fake narrative that too many who should know better are buying into now, and it scares me.
Well, Nicole, one of the reasons I'm here is that I've become very convinced that they're just much more louder than we are, and that the work that you do, the work that many of the new podcasters do, the whole center-left, you know, communications system and all these shows, we're now really on the front lines of the fight to save our democracy. Mm-hmm. Because what we learned in this election is the Republicans have the capacity, despite all of their malevolence and lying, to bully the national media through the sheer force of the media empire that they've built, the loudness of Fox News and the amplification, everything else. And we have to get much more intentional about being loud. I mean, one of the reasons we did so well in this election is that where we ran our national campaigns in the battleground, we were able to control the information environment, and we did much better. Where we didn't run these big, heavily funded national campaigns in places like Florida and Texas mm-hmm. and New York and California, we fell behind. And so to me, one of the big lessons here is that, you know, head to head, we learned heading into 2024 that we're in control of our own destiny in the battleground for 2024. Mm-hmm. Despite high inflation, Joe Biden's low approval, everything else, we gained ground in Pennsylvania and in Arizona and Colorado and in New Hampshire, right? We came out better than we were in 2020. Who could have imagined that a few months ago, right? It's an incredible performance by the Democratic Party, all of our donors. A lot of this money comes from the grassroots listeners of your show, who also go out and knock on doors and write postcards and do all the hard work that is so critical to maintaining the strength of our democracy. I was so inspired. I did so many Zoom chats with groups all across the country, being like a big cheerleader, right? Yeah. Saying, no, we got a shot. We got a shot. And I was so blown away by the passion and the energy of the groups that I was speaking to that they lifted me up. They made me strong and powerful and gave me faith that what I was seeing was correct. And so to me, this was a real victory of the people. You know, this was a people-led win for the Democratic Party. The American people said no. But we, you know, this work is still, so I head into 2024 very feeling like we've got, you know, the way we won this election is very, very important for how we have to conduct 2024. And it makes me feel like we are the favorites to win the presidency. We are the favorites to win back the House. The Senate is going to be hard, and mm-hmm. we're going to have a real fight in the Senate. But I think we should be very optimistic as we head into this next cycle that the basic dynamics of this election, which is that Democrats did a good enough job to not be kicked out of office, right? And that Republicans are too extreme for everybody, that dynamic's not going to really change heading up into the next election. It's still going to be Joe Biden, if he runs for re-election, or if he doesn't, whoever is the nominee will be able to say, hey, look, the country's better off today. Keep us in power, right? And they'll be able to say Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, whoever it is, you know, they're just, you know, they're too extreme and you just don't want to go there.
Right.
And I don't think they're going to have the ability to fundamentally change that dynamic. I don't think Ron DeSantis is going to be able to present himself easily. He's going to try, right? If he beats Trump, he'll be the guy that defeated MAGA. But I think it's going to be very hard for the Republican Party to shake two fundamental things that creates distance for them and voters, which is abortion, the abortion extremism, which is just a huge problem for them with not just women, but with many men too, particularly younger Americans who are of childbearing age, right? Mm-hmm. And also you know, that their general craziness of MAGA. And I think people have voted. Republicans have had three consecutive elections in a row where they've underperformed because the country just isn't, you know, there's an anti-MAGA majority in the country. So I think they've got real millstones around their neck heading into 2024, which I hope for your listeners is that we, you know, end this crazy election season resting up, but knowing that we've got a lot of work to do in the next 2 years to make sure that these folks don't get into power.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. Simon Rosenberg is our guest. Today we are audio only, so I usually rely on the Chiron to let you know who's on. Simon was one of the lone voices throughout the run-up to the voting in the midterm saying, don't believe what they're telling you. This whole idea of a red wave is more of the propaganda that they've been pushing. So as much as that, I also fault the Democrats. Then again, I've done that for a long time. But I think this is where we need to have a discussion about the Democratic Party. They got lucky. Their wins this time, I think, were partially due to the fact that Joe Biden may be boring, but he actually got a lot of stuff done. It would have been more if not for the duo that I love to call Manchinima, because those two, if not for them, we could have gotten a lot more done. And the damage done by this rightward swing of the what I call now the extreme court, because it's not a supreme anymore. I think, you know, most people are against that. And you have to believe that most people are going to vote in their best interests, even though many Republicans often vote against their own best interests. I think the overall majority, we're staring down fascism again, and we're not going to go there. So I that's why I wouldn't believe what the people that we tend to trust were telling us. But I also see some real problems within the Democratic Party. For instance, I have railed for a long time that we needed new leadership, especially in the House. You know, give Nancy Pelosi all the credit that she's due. She did a lot of good things, but I do believe she overstayed by a number of years. I think the future belongs to the next generation, and it was time to give them some responsibility. Let them take the lead in forging the future, and she held on for too long, as did Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn. So now, though, you know, it's a given that the next speaker or the next Democratic leader in the House will be Hakeem Jeffries. And I just watched a primary where he got behind a couple of groups that did everything they could to defeat progressives who were running both in primaries and in the general election. I don't see that as the way Democrats unite to go forward. Do you?
So let me just say that I know Hakeem, and he's a wonderful guy, and I think he's going to be a great leader. And I want to go back to your first point about the generational wheel that has begun to turn. Because I think this is actually, in some ways, among the most important things we're going to talk about today. Because in the next few years, and we don't know in what order and what sequence, I mean, we're going to see Joe Biden, you know, Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team have now stepped down. Joe Biden, whether he runs for re-election or not, you know, he will be fading from the national scene soon. Bernie Sanders will be departing, and that we're going to see a lot of space for a new generation to come and to take the baton from an older generation to lead us forward. And I have been doing this a long time. And when I look around and see the leaders of the next Democratic Party, from the new leadership team in the House to, you know, Gretchen Whitmer and Josh Shapiro and, you know, Reverend Warnock. I mean, make your own list. Gavin Newsom, we all have our own lists of people that we think these are remarkable people. I mean, we have a very, very strong party that's coming up, you know, by any historical measure. I think many of these candidates who survived in these last two elections in 2020 and 2022 in the Senate and the House are going to be battle tested and very, very strong and be important leaders. We have many leaders in the House of this class that just won in 2022 who've got strong national security credentials. So I think we'll be able to be thoughtful foreign policy leaders for a long time to come. And so when I look around at what's coming, I'm really excited about this. And I don't think we should fear this generational turn that's about to come.
Not at all.
And, you know, we should welcome it and embrace it. And I think that it's so I'm really excited about what's going to happen here. And I think that we, you know, the party got much stronger in this election and then it was because of the people, the candidates who were able to, particularly in the House. Remember, we lost seats in the House in 2020, despite Biden doing so well. Mm-hmm. So the people that have made it through 2022 now have survived two very adverse elections, meaning that they know how to win their districts. They know how to be successful politicians. This makes it much more likely that we reclaim the House in 2024. And I think on the question of the party infighting, I just think that we all have to learn how to get along. I mean, there can't be, to me, in my view, the single priority for House Democrats now has to be to come together and to unite around a set of candidates that are going to allow us to win the House back. We can have open primaries. Those are things that will happen. But what I think there has to be less of is that we have to stop having so many challenges against incumbents, because it can happen from time to time, but it's happening too much, and it's degrading our capacity to win general elections. And I hope that there's sort of a moratorium on that while we all get together with each other, right, and create a single team that goes out and tries to win this thing in 2024. That's the priority now. And I think some of the infighting that we saw in the Democratic Party, particularly because the House Democrats aren't going to be able to pass any legislation mm-hmm. over the next 2 years, I think some of that, we can put that aside, I hope, and come together around, you know, making sure that Joe Biden's reelected if he chooses to run, and that we win the House back and put the best team we can on the field in the Senate. I think the party came together in these last few months. I think there was a lot of struggle inside the family, as you're describing, mm-hmm. over the last year and a half. But I think we all, you know, came together at the end, and we needed to do that. And we have to get better at that. We're all playing different positions on the same team in the Democratic Party. We're not on different teams. We're on the same team. And we have to learn how to get along. I grew up in a family of six kids. I mean, I know what it's like, you know, to, you know, sit down at dinner with a lot of folks and get along with everybody. We have to do a little bit better at that, I think, going forward. And that's on all sides, right? That's not just one side. That's everybody learning how to get comfortable with folks that, you know, you may not agree with every day. And I think that, you know, there's going to be an opportunity for Hakeem to show the kind of leader he's going to be, the kind of inclusive leadership that I think he wants to provide for the caucus. But we'll see.
I hope that's the case, but I worry. I mean, I'll just point to Summer Lee as an example. The fact that he was aligned with groups that spent millions of dollars against her in a primary and then also in the general. That's not how we win. And he's said things about progressives. Now, I think here's where you and I sort of, we go separate ways. Yeah. And I gotta back up, because you founded the group NDN, New Democrat yep. Network. Yep. Are you affiliated with the New Dems caucus in the House? Did they grow out of your group? Are you aligned?
I created them.
You created them. You see, in that's yeah. Okay. Right.
And I'm here because there's more that unites us than divides us.
I agree.
I have spent my entire, you know, I have spent my entire career trying to bridge the ideological differences in the family. You know, my organization, in addition to everything we've talked about today, I helped introduce bilingual polling and Hispanic, you know, Spanish language advertising to the Democratic Party. I did the first poll of millennials that was ever done and helped craft our national, not just our national Hispanic strategy, but our national youth strategy. And because the New Democrats, at the end of the day, were Democrats, and they always viewed themselves as trying to build the next thing. And that was the origin of the term, right? Mm-hmm. It is New Democrats. There are other Democrats that are way to the right of the New Democrats.
Blue Dogs.
Blue Dogs and Manchin okay. Cinema, right? Yep. I mean, they're not the same. And nope. They shouldn't be lumped in with them. And, you know, and the New Democrat name was chosen on purpose because they were Democrats first, and they were more interested in fighting the forward backward battle than the left right battle. That's mm-hmm. the history of that group. And that group has been, as you saw, is very gender diverse and very regionally diverse and very racially diverse. And I think it was always saw themselves as the vanguard of the next thing. these are debates we'll be having, Nicole, a lot in the next few years.
Yes, we will.
And I think for now, what I'm an advocate of, and one of the reasons I love coming on your show, and I don't, because we're all on the same team here, mm-hmm. and the differences that we have are small compared to the differences that we have with the other side.
Absolutely.
And I think they're bridgeable. These are bridgeable differences. These are the normal, in my view, the debates that we had over the last 2 years on BBB and other things are the normal set of debates that happen in a healthy party, right? A healthy party is a party that doesn't have debates, mm-hmm. a healthy party that doesn't have disagreements. But the key is when you have those disagreements, you got to come together on the other side after you've had the debate. And I think the progressives had a lot of wins in this last election, and the non-progressive parts of the party had a lot of wins too. And I think that's what it takes to have a healthy coalition, is that everybody's got to get wins. And if either side feels left out, you don't have a healthy party. And so I'm optimistic about where this is all going. That's all. And I think certainly, you know, Hakeem is going to be, let's see how he does. Let's give him a shot.
Okay.
You know, he's a very talented, capable guy. I've known Hakeem for a long time. I met him long before he ran for office. And I've always been impressed with his integrity and his desire to do the right thing for people, right? He's got a very big heart. And I think we're going to see that on display. And it's going to be remarkable. I mean, he's the first African-American to ever be the leader of any party. It's kind of an historic moment for the Democrats, another historic moment after Nancy's leadership. And, you know, let's give him a shot and see what he can do.
Yeah, and of course we will, and because that's how we do things. I hope he rises to the occasion. As a diehard progressive, I was a little disconcerted when I saw Adam Schiff wanted to challenge him. I thought, good, let's have a race. But he backed off. And again, this isn't the year for the white guy to challenge the black guy for leadership. I get it. But that said, I still have a bad taste in my mouth knowing that he was aligned with this group, the AIPAC and the other one, Democrat Majority for Israel. I mean, come on. That's not what we do. That's what they do. And so, but I do understand that we all need to come together and work together in order to keep the Republicans from gaining back any ground. We need to get rid of them, especially the way today's Republican Party is, because they are a clear and present danger to the future of our democracy. I mean, I had many sleepless nights thinking that this is over. Great, I'm old, but I've got a 23-year-old daughter. I don't want to leave her in that world. So, but Simon, I got to ask about what you said about primarying incumbents, because I disagree with you there. Do you think AOC should not have primary Joe Crowley?
No, I think that it's different for a one-off like that. These things happen from time to time. There was, you know, she was a talented and capable person. It can't become a broad party-wide strategy, because what's going to happen is that people are going to stop running for office as Democrats if that happens. I mean, it can't be that if you're in a swing district that you're running for, you've got to beat a primary challenger every 2 years and then go win the general election. People just won't stay in Congress. I mean, the amount of work and labor that requires to go win two elections every 2 years is beyond the capacity of most human beings. And there's a sort of a practical reality in all this, as somebody who's been doing this for a long time, that this has to be an unusual thing as opposed to something that's common. And what's happening is it's becoming common, and that's going to debilitate and make it much, it's going to make it much harder for us to win the majority and keep it if a lot of our incumbents are having to win two elections every 2 years instead of one, because they're having to raise money and spend it in the primary to defending their seat, and that's money they can't spend to defeat Republicans. And so I think the progressives have some choices to make about how they approach this. And I think what's happened is they've been too ambitious and too aggressive, in my view, about this. I think these things are going to happen. I think where we should have the fights is in the open seats. In any party, the people in charge are going to defend the incumbents at all costs. That's just the way it's always going to be. And I think that if the progressives continue to challenge large numbers of incumbents, they're going to continue to isolate themselves in the Democratic caucus. There's a reason why the progressives, I think, are not going to be satisfied with the leadership races is because they were seen as not being team players in this last election cycle. And I think they can have it both ways. What I'm saying is, I think there's a way for the Progressive Caucus to stick to their guns and fight it out on policy and be more team players on the political end. They may not agree with me on that. I mean, this is a decision they have to make, but there's costs. The reason why Jayapal is not going to be in the leadership is because she was too active in recruiting candidates against incumbents who are never going to vote for her, and she pissed them off.
Should someone like Henry Cuellar have the full-fledged support of leadership? Should they go down the only anti-choice member of the Democratic caucus?
The answer is yes, because if we get to a place where it is the leadership abandons incumbents, we don't have a party anymore. I mean, this is where there's a degree of just basic pragmatism about the way this all works that we will have a spirited disagreement about, I'm sure, which is that they must defend the incumbents, period, at all costs.
What about in two years?
The party cannot abandon incumbents who want to run for re-election.
Wow.
Even if that incumbent
bucks the party at every turn and votes with the opposition.
As I said earlier, I think there are going to be isolated cases from time to time where there are going to be legitimate challenges to people, right? It cannot become something that is endemic and happening all the time, 30, 40, 50, 60 races. What's going to end up happening, and it happened this cycle, is that we spent tens of millions of dollars defending our incumbents instead of defeating Republicans. And it's very likely that the progressive strategy that attacked our incumbents cost us the House. I think that's a legitimate argument that has to be aired out, right? Because there were lots of incumbents that ended up spending a lot of money defending themselves in races where they won by 70-30 that were not serious races, but they had to spend the money. They were quixotic races by candidates that were never going to win. And, you know, that money that we spent defending our incumbents was not money we spent against Republicans. And that's money that, you know, we only lost this House by 5 seats and 4,000 votes.
Yeah.
And so I think the Progressive Caucus has used these tactics very effectively up until this point. I think that they are going to have to make a big decision, in my view, about whether or not, you know, there's a limit to how far they can go in attacking their colleagues and then expecting those colleagues to turn around and give them leadership positions. It's just basic way that we deal with each other. You attack me, I'm not gonna be for you, right? And so if Jayapal and the progressives want to work their way up into the leadership, the way, frankly, that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren did, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren don't endorse against incumbent senators in the Senate.
And incumbents.
Incumbents,
okay, so, right? but I firmly believe they both will in 2 years, whoever challenges Sinema.
Right. But then they may lose their leadership positions if they do that.
Wow.
And so the point is that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren are examples of people who work their way up through the system by being part of the team, right? And they're what this is where the progressive.
I have to laugh. For you to say that Bernie Sanders worked his way up by being part of the team, this was a guy who was shat on by the party for years for refusing to say he's a Democrat.
But he played ball inside the Senate leadership structure.
Yeah, he did.
He didn't attack Schumer. He didn't attack the previous. He played ball inside. And I think what I'm saying to you is the progressives in the House have to learn from the way that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren got into the leadership, and they have choices to make, right? There's different ways to do this. And I think my own view is that in this election cycle, those tactics need to be retired for now, because we have, to your point, and this is where you and I agree violently, right, is that we have a job to do here, which is we have to beat the Republicans. And we need to come together for now and put aside these differences, unite as a team, right? And I hope that some of the progressives take leadership roles in the DCCC and help us win the election. I think that would be smart for them to do, and to work inside the family to put a unified front out there. And these are choices. Look, these are choices. Very capable leaders of the Progressive Caucus in the House. Very capable leaders.
Yes, they are.
And they've got some decisions to make about how they want to you know, play the game.
All right. So, Simon, let me ask you one other question, because I think this was a serious misstep by one of the more conservative Democrats, the guy who was the head of the DCCC for the last cycle, who lost his seat. And some might say because he got too ambitious and tried to take a seat that he thought would be easier to win. And in the process, pushed out a progressive in Jamal Bowman, and Sean Patrick Maloney, for his efforts, is out of Congress. Do you think that was a smart move on his part?
Yeah, I mean, the person running the DCCC gets preference over the seat, just over and out, right?
Wow.
That's like, this guy's in charge of running the reelection. He had preference. You know, we had a bad redistricting that happened there. It was unanticipated, the court decision. And the notion that he should have gotten out of the way for a younger member is a joke.
Well, the incumbent, right? Who represented most of that district already.
That's not really what happened, and we could have a long debate about this. But I wanted to say to you, I came on the show in the spirit of, we all have to work together.
We do.
Right? There are a lot of things that you and I could talk about over the last couple of years that are, you know, things that we need to learn from and learn how to work better together. Mm-hmm. The redistricting stuff is very, very hard. There are always people who lose out in that process, particularly in states that are in declining areas where they lose seats. But certainly more deference should have been paid, I think, by the progressives to the person running. You said the number one job is to beat Republicans. There was one person who had that job. He should have been given the deference by the family let him have the easiest seat so he could focus on winning the House. He actually did a better job at competing nationally than he did potentially in his own district. And so I do think that the challenge against him in the primary was wrong. I think that he needed to be given the space to go do the job. He'd been given the job by the caucus. He was elected by the caucus to go keep the House. And there was too much interference with him, where he had to go back home and beat down a challenger. And that's what I mean about I think the Progressive Caucus has to get smarter about how it uses its power and not be so indiscriminate. The attacks on Sean Patrick Maloney were wrong and may have cost us the House. And some would say
that his actions and the way he was so protective of his own longevity in the House over letting the guy who represents most of that district already stay in that district, maybe that did it. I don't think it's so cut and dry, and this is where we disagree.
I know. And I think this is all water under the bridge. I mean, the point is, we could litigate this stuff and BBB all day long.
Yep.
And what I started with in this discussion was that whatever happened now, what's in front of us is that Republicans have a small majority. We have to stay focused on winning the House. We can't pass legislation in the House this cycle. And we're going to need to find a way to get along with all of each other and make sure that we're putting we're doing everything we can to elect Joe, if he decides to run for re-election, to re-elect Joe Biden president, and keep the Senate and win the House. And I think that there were mistakes made by many in this last election. I mean, there's no one reason we didn't win that House, but there are important conversations that need to be had about, you know, how we're going to get along as a party. Do we really want to become something that mirrors what's happened on the Republican side? I don't think we do, right? And so we need to learn from what happens when a Republican Party gets taken over by one of the, what happened on the Republican side is the establishment failed. And then people on the fringes of the party took over their party. They've been taken over by extremists and by extremism. The establishment of the Democratic Party hasn't failed, and we're not a failed entity. I mean, Joe Biden and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama have all been very good presidents. The country has been far better off under their time in office than under Republicans. And that the establishment Democratic Party, for all of its problems and all of its failures and all the disappointments, has been a competent and capable force for a very long time. We've governed well. We've won more votes in 7 out of 8 national presidential elections. It's the best showing of an American party in all of American history in terms of the popular vote. This is the best run, popular vote run of an American party in all of American history, right? We've been able to face down in 3 consecutive elections the threat of MAGA after this serendipitous victory that Trump had in 2016. And so I think that we have to find a way. And the reason I'm here today, right, is that I believe that we're all in this together. We're all playing different positions on the same team, and that we've got a really important thing to do together. And we won't win if we're not together, right? You hang together, you hang separately, that old line. I really believe that. And I'm not asking people to roll over and play dead, right? That's not what happened over the last 2 years. I think spirited debate is a sign of a healthy party.
Agree.
I think what we saw in the Democratic Party in the last 2 years was a healthy party.
For the most
part. People are there to go. I mean, I'm not going to talk about the Senate, right? I'm not going to talk about what happened with Manchin and Sinema. Okay. I think it's very difficult to understand that. I've been doing this a long time. I'm still not sure that I totally get what happened there. But I think that in general, you know, our time in 2 years, the reason why Joe Biden, the reason why we still have the Senate, the reason we came so close in the House is the American people believe we did a good job. And we did. And the country is much better off today because of our time in the White House. And that's, I just think, in my own view, is that if we can't get to a place where we're more, we see the glass half full as opposed to half empty, that we're not going to be a successful party. Because we have repeatedly made America better. They haven't. The contrast between our successful governance and their repeated failures should be the central thing that we're focusing on with our, you know, people in our family. And I have all, you know, I'm not going to tell you that Democratic Party has been perfect, right?
Right.
But we probably have been the greatest force for good in all of human history. The world that we built after World War II has created more opportunity for more people than any other political system in human history. More people of color and more women have opportunities around the world today than they've ever had in all of human history. And that's a political system that we built
right.
in the 1940s. And so I'm proud to be part of that party. And I know that we're being called again, as we have been in the last three elections, to defend the global order that Roosevelt built for all of us in the 1940s, to make sure that our kids, to your point, I have three kids who are 22 and 20 and 17, mm-hmm. you know, get to have the same opportunities that we have.
Yeah.
And I think that's our biggest struggle now. It's not these internal fights with each other. These are normal things that happen inside a party. The thing we have to stay focused on is we cannot let MAGA will win if we become divided. If right. we have to right. stay together well. And to achieve this common thing, which is defeating MAGA, excising MAGA out of our political system, preserving democracy, creating opportunity for people as we have before, finishing the fight against climate change, all these things that we all want, that we all did together, right? I mean, look at the achievements of the last 2 years. They were remarkable, what we were able to do. And I'm proud. And I'm proud that that came about after intense internal debate, let's call it. One could call it fighting, right? Uh-huh. And out of intense debate, I think our Congress was built to create intense debate. That's why our founding fathers designed this system of government. They expected unbelievably intense debate, and out of that, they thought good things would come. And you know what? That's what we saw in the last 2 years. And so I'm really proud of our party. I think that we've, for all the good that we've done in the last few years, the next few years could even be more important and consequential.
Without a doubt.
And so I'm going to keep fighting.
Good.
Every day. And as I know you will, too.
I will. We both will. And let me just say two more things. One is we agree on a lot more than we disagree about. There's that. All right, I'm going to leave this other stuff aside. I do want to put that you are doing a talk a week from tomorrow, I believe, yeah. December 6th. It's something that you've done before. It's with Democrats, things are better. Tell us what this is about.
So thank you for ending on such a good, happy note, right?
An
optimistic
you got it.
Note. So because I've been doing this so long, I'm just tired. I'd rather fight with Republicans than
I understand. I understand. We have some differences of opinion, and I think, you know, that we need to have respect for both sides. And the other thing I was going to say is the extreme on the Republican side is Marjorie Taylor Greene, is Lauren Boebert, is Paul Gosar. We don't have that on the left. I'm sorry. I don't care what you think about AOC or Ilhan Omar or anybody else. We don't have those crazies. There are no extremes on the left.
I'm a new Democrat, and I agree with you.
Cool.
I agree with you 100% on what you just said. They are not comparable in any way.
No way at all.
I agree with AOC about that 100%.
Good.
And I saw her say that on national television. She's absolutely right about that. There's no comparison there's not symmetry between the two parties. There's asymmetry.
Yes.
We have a very different journey. They've been on a very different journey than we have.
Okay.
And so what I'll say is that the presentation I do If you like my happy, optimistic, Twitter feed over the last few months,
which we need,
a lot of that comes from a presentation that I began many, many years ago in a different form, which I just look back at American history since 1989 and the Berlin Wall fell, and sort of a new global system was created. Right, we went from the West and a billion to 2 billion people who are part of our economic orbit to 7 billion people. And we had an entirely new global economic and political system, this age of globalization, as it's called. And I've done a presentation that looks back in this period when everything changed to ask this basic question, which is, how have the two parties done in managing the big changes that have taken place since 1989, right? You could go down the list, right? We had the rise of terrorism and, the rise of globalization and China and now COVID. I mean, there's so many things the internet. I mean, just think about all the things that have changed since 1989. How have the two parties done in managing and building a politics against that change? And what I show is the Democrats have done a really good job at that. Of the 46 million jobs that have been created since 1989, 44 million of them have been created under Democratic presidents, basically all of them. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden has created more jobs in his first 21 months in office than was created by the last three Republican presidents combined over 16 years. And I go through and show a lot of data that shows that the basic story of our time is that Democrats have been a good party. And when we've been in power, we've made things better. And the Republicans, when they've been in power, things have gotten worse. Mm-hmm. We've had three consecutive recessions, spiraling deficits. America has made progress when we've been in power, and we've declined when they've been in power. To me, this central contrast, which is not left and right, where they're equally the same, as you were pointing out earlier, because I reject that, is that this basic contrast we should be making, we shouldn't be talking about left and right. We should be talking about good and not so good. We should be talking about progress versus decline. And that we have to reorient our politics, I think, around we have to reject at every notion this basic, frame of left and right. Left and right is a Republican construct. It's a construct of the right to hide their extremism. Mm-hmm. We should reject it. And what I'm trying to do is create a different, to use George Lakoff's term, right, a different frame about how we look at American politics, which is that we've done good and they haven't. And I think that basic understanding is not nearly adequately expressed in the national discourse. And I'll end by saying this, is that the reason I'm still doing this at my age, and I'm not young anymore, is that I'm so proud to be a Democrat. I'm proud of what Bill Clinton did. I'm proud of what Barack Obama did. I'm proud of what Joe Biden's done. I'm proud of the Democrats that came before. And when you see the data that I amass and I assemble and show the contrast between our good works and their not so good works, right? Their repeated failure. I think you're going to come away with a very different understanding of what could be our history as a country since 1989. And I think it's incumbent upon people like us, Nicole, who have platforms, who can speak to people, regardless of what flavor of Democrat mm-hmm. or progressive we are, to do a better job at telling this story of our success and their failure as the fundamental way that we look at American politics. And that's what that presentation is about. It's free and open to all. A lot of the charts and graphs that you'll see in it have been adopted by the White House, actually. And this is a very popular presentation in the White House. Joe Biden, if you watch him in many of his economic events, he's got a chart next to him which shows jobs per month under the various presidents. That came directly from this presentation. And so this has been very well received in the family. And I do it once a month for anyone to come watch. And there's also a recording. And I update it every time. There's always new data. I update the economic numbers. And there's also a recording of it. If you can't make it on the 6th, you can watch a recording on my website at ndn.org.
Okay. And this next talk will be Tuesday, December 6th, the week from tomorrow, 1 p.m. Yep. Eastern. You can RSVP. Just go to ndn.org. You look for With Democrats, Things Get Better. And all the information is there. And it is true. And that's why I wanted to have you on. I know we disagree on some things, but overall, we've got a lot more in common than yeah. And we have a country to save.
Nicole, and I just want to say before we go is that thank you. Thank you for your passion, your commitment, your fight, your sticking it out every day. You're a vital resource for your listeners and your viewers. And I'm here to say thank you, right? I mean, I've now really come to believe in the work I've done in the last 6 months that the National Party doesn't really understand the importance of the sort of organic communications infrastructure that has sprung up. Your work, Midas Touch, right? You know, the Deep State Radio, Courier Newsroom, which is run by a brilliant young woman named Tara McGowan, who I've gotten to know in the last 6 months. There's so much entrepreneurial spirit right now. People are rising up. They're doing their part. We're being big citizens. We're being patriots. And I'm going to do everything I can, whether I agree or disagree. I mean, we could debate these things all day long. We're still all patriots working together, and I'm here to say thank you for your work. And let me know how I can support you in any way going forward. And good luck. I mean, this is an incredibly important fight, and I appreciate you love being in the trenches with you every day.
Well, me too. And thank you. Thank you for your kind words, and thank you for the work that you continue to do. Again, we may have disagreements, but we're on the same team, and we need to work together in order to stop the evil from permeating this country. And we've got big challenges that we're working against. And in this case, it really is good versus evil. Sometimes you say it and it's not real. This time it's real. So we're on the right team. We just need to work together. Simon Rosenberg, thank you so much. Are you staying on Twitter?
Yes, I am for now. you know, this is going to be a painful transition, but for now I'm there and we'll see what happens. I'm trying to do more on YouTube. I'm experimenting with some of the other sites. It's going to take a while. Yeah. I mean, this is going to be a tough transition, but I'm there. Simon WGC, come follow me. I still where I do most of my work, my most important writing. I think I use it as a sketch pad, and I get such great feedback from people about things that I put out there every day. I really treasure the relationships I've developed over Twitter. I'm going to miss it because I know that it's not long. It's not long for the world. I mean, I don't know the timetable, but it's intolerable what Elon's doing. And I don't really want to talk about it because it's.
And you said, don't even talk about him. Just leave him alone.
No, leave him alone. We have to stay. Nicole, my challenge to everyone, given what I've learned this year, is that we have to live more in the light in the darkness, that we have to be more conscious of producing positive sentiment in the world, because I think the fundamental tactic of the broader MAGA movement, including Putin and his allied organizations, is to have America feel less good about itself, less good about each other, less good about our leaders, less good about our institutions, less good about democracy, less good about this project that we're all part of. Their job is to make us feel bad about all of this. Our job has to make us make us feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to start becoming aware that being upbeat and being optimistic and being glass half full and talking about the progress we've made, but still all the work that still needs to be done, right, is going to be critical for us to win in this battle against authoritarianism, because their central tactic is to demoralize, to make us feel bad, to push the red wave, to make us feel like we're going to lose, to make us feel bad about our collective project. And what I just did is I stood up to the red wave and I said, I'm not willing to take it. We're better than this as a country, as a party, as a family. Joe Biden is better than what people are saying. And I'm not willing to take the red wave as being where things are. And I think that, so my final message to all of you, and Nicole, you have an important platform, is that we have to learn how to be, sorry, I've had a terrible cold, is that we have to learn how to be, lift each other up more instead of tear each other down more. And I think this kind of internal infighting in the party, while it can be debate, it can't be fighting. And we have to be respectful, as I'm being here today with you, right? Is that we have to be respectful. As Obama said it was sort of a cutesy thing he said, but I think it actually was really meaningful, which is that, you know, we all have to learn how to disagree without being disagreeable.
Right.
And that's really what a democracy is all about, right? I mean, if you think about it, a democracy is about a coming together. A Congress is about a coming together of people with disparate views and from different regions and different genders and different races to forge the common good for the country. If we can't do it with each other, we're not going to be able to do it for the country either. And that's why these skills about learning how to work in a coalition and to view yourself as not as factions, but as part of a floating, changing coalition, is really, in my view, a better way to look at how we all get along. Nicole, I don't want to change your views on anything. Mm-hmm. I want you to be who you are. But it's, and I expect that you will respect mine as well, as Absolutely. You did tonight. You gave me my chance to do it. Right? Yep. I went on Fox News for 17 years, unpaid as a guest, because I wanted to show Republicans that there were Democrats who could be respectful of them. I fought like hell when I was on the air. I didn't give an inch ever. Mm-hmm. But I always ended by saying thank you. And I said, please. And I was respectful because uh-huh. in a democracy, we have to exhibit that kind of sense that we're all in this together. And that's what we've lost as a country.
Yeah.
We don't feel that we're all in this together. And I think we have to learn how to exhibit that in our own behavior every day with each other. And that's why it's really a pleasure to be with you here today, Nicole. Thank you so much for it.
Thank you so very much. Simon Rosenberg, I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do this again soon.
Absolutely.
All right.
I'll be back anytime.
Thank you so much. All right. Feel better. You sounded great. And take care of yourself.
Thank you.
We got a lot of fight ahead of us. So, all right. Thanks, Simon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. I thought that was a great discussion. I hope you agree. I think it was necessary. And we do have more in common than divides us. And yet we still have differences. And it's okay to have those differences. But we need to know that in the end, we have each other's backs. Because if we don't, we know what we wind up with. And that's unacceptable. All right. Tomorrow, I will have video working again. If not, just shoot me now. No, take that back. No shooting. No, none of that. I'll have it working tomorrow. thanks for your patience today. And, you know, hey, it's live radio. Shit happens. All right. With that, we're done. A little late, but we're done. I think for the podcast, what I'll probably do is just edit together the conversation with Simon because it went for about an hour. So I'll cut out the beginning and the technical stuff and just put that out. But I will, as always, leave you with the news, and I'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks again, everyone. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Onward. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Thanksgiving is over, and lawmakers return to D.C. for what should be a very busy three-week-long lame duck session to close out the 117th Congress. On the agenda, government funding expires on December 16th. What's still unsettled is whether they'll be able to pass a bipartisan full-year appropriations bill or just kick it down the road with another continuing resolution. The National Defense Authorization Act is also a must-pass, but with the Republicans taking over control of the House in January, many want to delay its passage so they could target policies ranging from vaccine mandates to diversity measures. Pelosi would like to pass it before handing over the gavel. We'll see. But that brings us to Kevin McCarthy's quest for the Speaker's gavel. The race for the Republican leader will come down to a vote on January 3rd. McCarthy will need the support of all but three or four members of his conference. But over the weekend, it seems like a fifth Republican signaled no support for McCarthy. Prepare for a fight. On the Senate side, they're expected to pass the Respect for Marriage Act this week after 12 Republican senators helped Democrats advance the bill, ensuring that same-sex and interracial marriages remain protected nationally. And also, under the time crunch, is the bipartisan Electoral Count Act overhaul. Many on the Democratic side are trying to attach this bill to the appropriations or the NDAA. Lots of deal-making to get done. Following a devastating holiday weekend filled with even more gun violence, President Biden says his priority is to try to get rid of assault weapons. But Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut on the Sunday shows said that the Democrats don't have the 60 votes needed to advance an assault weapons ban. Murphy did express optimism that something might get done in the next Congress if Raphael Warnock retains the Senate seat in Georgia, but he said there needs to be a conversation in the Senate about funding law enforcement in counties that are refusing to enforce state and national gun laws. The nation is responding with general disgust over reports about the former guy hosting Kanye West and Nick Fuentes, the latter a Holocaust denier and white supremacist, for dinner at Mar-a-Lago last week. You might recall Kanye West was dropped from a number of his partnership deals after making anti-Semitic remarks last month. The Justice Department has labeled Fuentes as a white supremacist. He's known to be a racist and a Holocaust denier. But Donald Trump defended the dinner. He described Kanye West as, quote, a seriously troubled man who happens to be black. And then, of course, as he tends to do, he claimed he didn't know who Fuentes was prior to the dinner. Our dinner meeting was intended to be Kanye and me only, but he arrived with a guest whom I had never met and knew nothing about. Yeah, the same way he refused to disavow David Duke in 2016 and other white supremacists who supported his campaign by saying, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? No, not okay. Last week, we saw Dr. Anthony Fauci deliver what will likely be his final White House press briefing. And this weekend, he appeared on a few Sunday shows. Regarding COVID, he said that the nation is in a much better situation than it was last year, but said that the coronavirus pandemic is, quote, certainly not over. Fauci noting that 300 to 400 people are still dying every day from COVID-19. Meanwhile, in China, protests have erupted across the country over the weekend against that government's zero COVID policy and the leaders enforcing it. Residents in China have lived through almost 3 years of very strict controls that include repeated COVID tests, surveillance of their movement and health status, and ongoing lockdowns. But China's not the only unusual place where protests have taken over. Let's look at Iran, where Iranian Major General Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, warned people to stop these protests, especially in one province in eastern Iran where the country's military has cracked down particularly hard. He said, we will definitely turn this huge sedition scene into a burial ground for the policies of America, Israel, and its allies. At least 440 people have been killed in clashes with security forces since the protests began after Mahsa Amini died in police custody. And the protests in Iran have spilled over to the World Cup. Iran on Sunday protesting the U.S. soccer's social media post that showed an altered image of Iran's flag. What they cut out was the emblem of the Islamic Republic. So here's what happened. The U.S. soccer team told CNN on Sunday that it changed the official Iranian flag image for 24 hours, quote, in support for the women in Iran fighting for basic human rights. They said they always planned to put the original flag back up, but Iranian media called for the U.S. to be kicked out of the World Cup for, quote, posting a distorted image of the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran on its official account, which Iranian media said violated the global soccer governing body's charter. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.